Our first argument went longer than it usually would, so assuming that the parties in the interest of JKR, TPR, and concerning NH and MAH and APPR are here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. And have you received the, you can sit down. Have you received the written instructions for oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
And had a chance to review them? Any questions?
No, Your Honor.
All right, and once again, I'll ask everybody in the courtroom, please check your cell phones, make sure they're turned off. And with that, now we'll turn to People Against Everett, the appellant may argue.
May it please the court. I'm Anthony Noble, and I represent the defendant, Brian Everett. The main issue in this case...
Mr. Noble, can you speak more loudly, please? And,
yes.
And if you want, you can raise the podium if that'll help you get the microphone up. Thank you.
Okay. The main issue in this case is whether the trial court abused its discretion by allowing the prosecution to introduce evidence of a prior bad act of Mr. Everett. The evidence that the prosecution was seeking to introduce was an alleged sexual assault in the state of Pennsylvania. The alleged victim in that case is referred to in the briefs as JJ. The prosecution argued that this evidence was admissible pursuant to 404B because it was relevant to show intent, lack of mistake or accident, common plan or scheme, opportunity and knowledge. The trial court conducted a SPOTO analysis and determined that the prior act was too dissimilar to the act in this case, and therefore denied the admission of that evidence in a written order. The trial court ruled first that the prior act was not logically relevant to the issues in this case, and also ruled that the prior act, the probative value of the prior act, was outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. Now, in that written order, the trial court did say that it would reverse its decision if Mr. Everett did pursue the defense of consent later on during the trial. What happened next was defense counsel filed a notice endorsing both a general denial defense and a defense of consent. And the prosecutor then renewed its motion to introduce the prior act evidence. This time, the trial court ruled that the evidence was relevant, but it was only relevant to the issue of consent. It didn't do anything to overrule its decision that the evidence wasn't relevant to the other issues that the prosecutor wanted to introduce the evidence for. At trial, prior to the evidence being given, there were two witnesses on the prior act evidence. One was a woman referred to as JJ, who was the person who was allegedly sexually assaulted by Mr. Everett in the state of Pennsylvania, and the other witness was a detective from the state of Pennsylvania. Prior to their testimony, there was a discussion between the trial court, defense counsel, and the prosecutor on what kind of limiting instruction to give to the jury. There was a discussion about whether to give the jury an instruction that the prior act evidence is limited to the defense of consent, or whether to also instruct the jury that it's also limited to not only the prior act, the defense of consent, but also to intent and motive. After some discussion, the trial court gave an instruction to the jury that the prior act evidence was solely related to the defense of consent, and that the jury could not consider that prior act evidence for any other reason. So the issue here is whether that prior act is relevant to refute the defense of consent in this case. And there are no reported cases in this state which consider the logical relevance of a prior act to the issue of consent solely. Whenever the issue of consent has been raised in a reported opinion in this state, it has always been one of the purposes of introducing the evidence, along with intent, lack of mistake, common plan or scheme, opportunity, knowledge, etc.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Noble. Isn't there a statute that specifically allows the introduction of prior act evidence in sex assaults when the defense is consent?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the statute is section 16, I think it's 1610.301. And that statute does allow prior act evidence to be admitted on the issue of consent. But what it doesn't explain is what is the issue of consent? What prior acts are relevant to what kind of consent? And the argument in this case that I'm making is that the consent first is personal to the victim. Whether someone consented, that's an issue of, you know, did that victim consent? It's not an issue of, you know, did the defendant, was the defendant aware of the consent? And even though there's a statute that allows prior act evidence to be admitted to refute the defense of consent, I don't think that this is a case in which this prior act evidence has any logical relevance at all to the issue of consent in this case. In this case, we have one woman in Pennsylvania who claims that she didn't consent to sexual intercourse with Mr. Everett. And then we have another woman in this state who also claims that she didn't consent to sexual intercourse with Mr. Everett. So there's no logical relevance between one woman's lack of consent and another woman's lack of consent.
Mr. Noble, I guess I'm confused. I'm trying to understand how far your argument goes. Is it your argument that there can never be a logical relevance where consent is the issue? And if not, what's the line that you're drawing for us? Because I'm not quite sure I understand how far your argument goes.
Yeah, and I understand you, because I've been trying to think when prior acts would be relevant to the issue of consent. And the only scenario that I can think of really would be when the prior act involves the same victim as the current act. Because then there is going to be some relevance between the issue of consent, because we've got the same person consenting or not consenting to sexual intercourse. Whereas when you've got different people, different victims, there's really no relevance. The only bridge between the two acts would be the intent of the defendant. But in this case, the evidence was admitted solely to refute the defense of consent. It wasn't admitted for intent or motivation. The trial court did have that discussion with defense counsel and the prosecutor prior to giving the limited instruction, but rejected giving an instruction on motive and intent. So we have the prior act evidence being admitted for the refuting the defense of consent only.
But Mr. Noble, again, pardon me for interrupting you, but isn't consent the other side of intent? And doesn't Colorado case law talk about it in that way?
Yes, Your Honor, and I even said that in my opening brief as well. But in this case, though, given the jury a limited instruction on intent was rejected by the trial court, there was some argument between defense counsel and the prosecutor, and the trial court decided that it was only going to instruct the jury that this prior act evidence can only be considered to refute the defense of consent.
Let me posit to you a hypothetical. Assume that you have a woman who says, "This man forced himself on me. I did not consent to sex. He forced me into sex." If she is believed, that's sexual assault. Assume in the second case, a second witness would testify to the same thing and would testify about certain factors that are similar in the two situations. If the jury is there to decide, did the victim in this case before us consent? Isn't that second case helpful? Perhaps because of some of the similarities, to help the jury decide, ah, the jury, the woman consented here or did not consent here?
Well, I agree, Your Honor, to an extent that the evidence would be helpful, but it would be helpful for the wrong reasons, because what it really shows is that the defendant has a propensity to have sex with women without their consent. It doesn't really go to the issue of whether the second woman consented or not, because that consent is personal to the victim. It's nothing to do with the defendant.
But doesn't the doctrine of chances operate here? Wouldn't we have circumstances in which, without speaking about the defendant himself, we would just be we couldn't avoid the notion that this is not a coincidence, that there was a woman in another state who says she was raped in a particular way, and now there is a woman in this state who says that the same guy raped her in a particular way. Doesn't that tell us that this is not a coincidence? Isn't that enough under the doctrine of chances?
Well, Your Honor, the way that you described it, that you know, both acts were similar, yes, I mean, that would make the prior act evident more probative. But in this case, the two acts were not similar. The trial court ruled on the very first motion to admit the evidence that there were so many dissimilarities between the two acts that's one of the reasons why the trial court denied the people's motion to admit the evidence pursuant to 404B. So, yes, I agree that where there are similar acts, then the prior act's evidence is more probative. But that's not the case here. The case here is we have completely different acts. So the only issue is the consent, and the consent is not related. The consent in the prior act is not related to the consent in this case. So the only logical relevance of the prior act is the issue of consent. It has no other relevance. The trial court ruled that. It had little or no probative value, and whatever value it did have was outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice to Mr. Everett. This isn't a case where there was overwhelming evidence. This is a case in which consent was a big issue. The trial court realized that consent was an issue by allowing the prosecutor to admit this testimony. The prosecution realized that consent was a big issue by spending the money to bring two witnesses from Pennsylvania to testify at the trial in this case. During closing argument, the defense counsel pointed out many problems that the prosecution had in proving this case, which is why they had to rely on this prior act's evidence. There were inconsistent statements made by the alleged victim. Her stories were different stories to different people. The nurse who examined the alleged witness said that the marks on her back were superficial and were not inconsistent with consensual sex. The nurse also said that there were no bruises around her neck or on her throat. Amadeus Holland, who was the jail inmate who testified about the statement that Mr. Everett allegedly made to him, was a felon with numerous prior convictions, many of them for theft and fraud. And in this case, the police didn't initially believe the alleged victim, and there was a time when they suspended the investigation because the victim was not cooperating with them. So this isn't a case where there was overwhelming evidence. This is a case where whatever probative value that prior act had, it clearly did prejudice Mr. Everett at trial.
What, if anything, did the prosecutor say about the prior act in closing argument?
The prosecutor didn't say anything about the prior act during closing argument. The prosecutor made quite a lengthy argument on the issue of consent, but did not mention the prior act. And I think the reason for that was because the only logical relevance of the prior act is to show that Mr. Everett had the propensity to commit sexual assault, and therefore they must have feared a mistrial. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, Jonathan Farrow, registration number 35754, representing the people of the state of Colorado. There are a few points I'd like to emphasize this afternoon to the court on the 404B issue. First, I agree, Judge Loeb, with your characterization. That was how I interpreted the defendant's argument initially, that he was essentially arguing that other act evidence is never really admissible to refute the defense of consent. And that's just not the law in Colorado. The McKibben case expressly rejected the very same argument. And numerous cases since that time have recognized consent as a proper purpose to admit other act evidence. One of the ones that I cited in the brief, the Martinez case, did involve other victims. I can't speak for the other two because I don't have them with me today, but I am certain that the Martinez case was not a situation that defense counsel was hypothesizing where you had the same victim with prior misconduct. Martinez case was a victim and then numerous other women who were brought in to rebut the defense of consent. And as you pointed out, Judge Bernard, it is actually codified by the General Assembly in section 1610.3013. Incidentally, it is the very first purpose listed in that statute. Now, along with this consent, the defendant tries to shift it into intent and abrogate that purpose as well, citing the Gilbo case. But Leonard, which came out after Gilbo, expressly rejected that reasoning. And the Supreme Court of this jurisdiction clarified the issue in Rath when they clarified that whether a material fact is contested, clearly, while it affects the need for incremental probative value of the evidence offered to prove it, it does not make the fact itself any less material or the evidence offered to prove it any less logically probative. In other words, if anything, this comes in under the fourth spot-o prong, not the first or the second prongs. And the way I've read the defendant's argument is that's where he's trying to end this case. The defendant also argues that the other act here was pure propensity. Well, this is a sexual assault case, and the other act was another sexual assault. The nature of these cases, and has been well recognized by the courts in this jurisdiction, is that in sexual assault cases, every time you bring in another act, whether it's the same victim, other victims, it doesn't matter, you are potentially raising a propensity inference. That's the danger with these types of cases. But our legislature and the Supreme Court Rules Committee and the court itself, in adopting 404B, made a policy decision that that does not bar the admission of other acts. What is required is that the other act has relevance, which is independent from propensity. And as the Leonard case stated it, the evidence must indicate more than bad character. And that is the case here. The other act in this case raised an independent inference that the defendant knowingly inflicted sexual penetration on J.H. without her consent and caused her submission through the actual application of physical force or violence.
Mr. Farrow,
yes.
Doesn't Spoto say of the independent of an intermediate inference regarding propensity?
Okay.
What's the significance of that word intermediate?
I don't think that there's a lot of significance other than recognizing that the inferences of propensity and the inference that is logically relevant and permissible under the rule are somewhat connected. There's a nexus between them.
It's okay to say the prior act shows that this person has a propensity for sexual assault, and based on that propensity, we can conclude here that this woman didn't consent.
No, I disagree with that. It's not okay. It's okay if it raises a propensity inference, but it must also raise an independent inference. And it is simple enough to say that that inference made it more likely than not that, and you raised the doctrine of chances yourself, Judge, and I think that would apply in this situation. As long as there's something else, if there's something more than bad character that is inferred from that other act, that's sufficient. That makes it independent.
But the inference has to not have propensity as an intermediate step. Would you agree?
I guess in that sense, then, I don't read it, I don't quite know what that means. It's somewhat of a cryptic phrase.
But I mean, it seems to me that we never, the proof that a prosecutor has to show is never propensity. It's always an element of the crime.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't it be so then that if you could show propensity, you will always be showing something else? I mean, unless we could get concerned with this intermediate issue, the rule evaporates, doesn't it?
Well, again, I think ultimately you're talking about a policy judgment that was made when the rule was adopted.
By the Spoto Court.
Well, by the Supreme Court Rules Committee and, you know, in 404B itself and the legislature. And, I mean, of course, Spoto interpreted that.
Okay.
Counsel, the statute postdates Garner and Spoto. Is that correct?
Postdates? Yeah, I'm not entirely sure, Judge. Perhaps you know. But I know that it does predate the enactment of 404B.
The 1610-30.
I believe so, yes. Yes. Which is probably the only explanation for why it exists. But that's a whole other issue. On to the fourth step of Spoto. The defendant claims that the people concede a poor probative value by arguing the strength of the other evidence that was admitted. That is the victim's actual testimony in this case and then the testimony of Mr. Harlan, for example, about the confession. We make no such concession. Just because the admission of the other act did not harm the defendant in this case, just because it did not substantially influence the verdict or impair the fairness of the trial, does not mean that its probative value was weak or substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice. The need for another act is only one factor to be considered. And in any event, as the Rath Court explained, where the disputed testimony of the victim is the only direct evidence of the commission of the act, additional evidence that corroborates the victim's testimony is particularly probative. And that's really the case here. And then I'd also like to add that, and this sort of addressed the defense arguments that we have two different rulings here by the trial court, and you can't consider the first ruling whatsoever. That leaves it off for only the purpose of consent. And that is, the defendant shifted the equities of the 403 analysis. He didn't just raise a general denial in this case. He defended with consent. It was his right to do so, of course, but by doing that, he placed an inference before the jury that was adverse to the victim and adverse to the prosecution. Prosecution carries the burden of proof, and therefore responding with the other act to rebut the defense of consent was not unfair. I would almost analogize it to a situation of opening the door. I know it's a different case, a different situation, a different context, but it's been recognized that a similar thing occurs in that situation. I think it's very similar to this.
Well, but, I mean, I don't know how far that argument takes you. It may not be unfair, but at the end of the day, still the prosecution still had to satisfy those photo elements, correct?
Correct.
I mean, just the fact that the defendant raised the issue of consent doesn't mean that stuff automatically comes in. At the end of the day, either the Spoto elements were satisfied or they weren't.
Okay. Absolutely, I agree, Your Honor. And then let me back up for a moment and address that a little bit more carefully. The defendant says that consent is personal to the victim. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. There's many cases in this jurisdiction. Martinez is one of them that talks about intent being the other side of the coin of consent and fabrication, accident, mistake. Those are all sort of the same kind of defenses. I think consent is a very specific form of that defense, because you're admitting that the act occurred, you're admitting sexual intercourse and whatnot, you're just saying that, well, she consented. Well, what else are you saying? You're also necessarily saying that that you've intended, you acted knowingly, you inflicted sexual penetration without consent, you caused the submission of that victim through the application of physical force or violence. So you can't just put this entirely on the victim. Raising the defense of consent opens up the defendant's intent, his motive. There's no other way that you can look at it. And the courts of this jurisdiction recognize that. And nothing in the trial court's prior order really prevents that from operating in this case.
Well, but if that's the case, then how's the jury supposed to figure out what they're supposed to do if the judge tells them you can only use this for purposes of consent?
I think that it's just logically evident. Consent as applied to the elements of this case. And that is that he knowingly affected sexual penetration without her consent and caused her submission, that is tied in with consent, through the application of physical force and violence. Now, I mean, it's an interesting issue that arose below about should we talk about intent, should we tell them about motive and all that. You know, it doesn't matter. It wasn't necessary. And I think it was appropriate to just tell them consent, because what that did is it said, look, you're not looking at intent in general or motive in general, period. You're restricted only in the context of consent. And with that, I would stand on the brief unless this court has any further questions. And the people would ask that this court affirm Mr. Everett's conviction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Noble, you have about a minute and a half.
The Attorney General referred to the Martinez case, saying that that was one case which considered how prior acts are relevant to the defense of consent. But that's another example of why this case is so unique. Because in the Martinez case, consent wasn't the only issue that the prior act was relevant to. In the Martinez case, the court also allowed the evidence to be admitted to show common plan, scheme, design, and modus operandi. So Martinez really doesn't help us because there's really no analysis on how a prior act is relevant to the issue of consent in this case. There's nothing about consent in that case other than mentioning that the evidence was admitted for the purposes of refuting the defense of consent. Another point that was made by the Attorney General was about propensity, and that's something that is specifically prohibited by Section 1610.301. The word propensity is used in 1610.301, whereas the phrase bad character is used in 404B. So propensity is specifically prohibited. The Attorney General argued that the defense of consent does not open up intent. Well, it does open up intent and motive, but in this case, the trial judge specifically ruled that the evidence, the prior act evidence, was solely limited for the consideration of the defense of consent.
Thank you, Mr. Noble.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The case stands submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course. We'll move on now to the final case.